Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on February 15, 2018. This is the week 6 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study, based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This class is on the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. The Buddha describes right effort. Right effort is generating the skillful desire, actions, and diligence to avoid inappropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. It takes a certain level of concentration and mindfulness and refers directly to the virtuous factors, what we should be mindful of. Abandon inappropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have arisen. In other words, if we're acting in an unskillful way, simply recognize it and abandon it. Develop appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. And how do we know what those are? They're within the framework of the Eightfold Path. There's nothing left up to be guessed at or to practice in an uninformed way. We know exactly what we need to do to awaken. Maintain appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds for continual development of non-confusion and skillful qualities that have arisen. Those are the Buddha's words on right effort. As you can see, right effort relates directly to understanding the origination and the clinging to that which gives brings suffering, dukkha. Again, everything the Buddha taught was in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. He never taught anything outside of that. And so the concentration factors follow the wisdom factors and the virtuous factors in developing an effective Eightfold Path. Is that clear? So what's really interesting to note, I think this is the fourth or fifth time that we've gone through the course in our Sangha. And each time we go through it, there's a deepening understanding of, oh yeah, the Eightfold Path is really the framework that the Buddha taught for awakening, rather than as it's often taught, either as an anachronism completely, or that it's the Eightfold Path that we've developed something even better, and we've used that as a foundation for our new Dharma practice. Of course, this is a path that an awakened human being taught, and I've yet to come across anything that improves on it. Sometimes just using 8 and something, and that just giving the number 8 to something lends it credence when it's just the number that there is sharing, but no real philosophy. Again, I'm not putting down anything else, just to be clear. The Buddha taught something very specific, very direct, and much is lost when it's accommodated to fit something else. Even the using the words right or wrong or skillful or unskillful points that there's a proper way to develop practice. I'm going to skip parts of what you read. The Buddha's words, one efforts to abandon wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong mindfulness, and wrong meditation, and develop right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, and right meditation. He concludes that by saying, this is one's right effort, very clearly. Developing the Eightfold Path the way it was taught and the way it was intended, without the need to add to it or subtract from it. That is one's right effort. And so abandon what is unskillful, meaning craving and clinging, and develop what is skillful, the Eightfold Path. Again, simple and direct instructions. The Buddha concludes that by saying, if it were not possible to abandon what is unskillful and develop what is skillful, I would not even teach this. And you think about that, to hold himself up as an awakened human being and then to teach something that human beings can't develop would be the essence of cruelty, wouldn't it? I mean, it really would. All that would serve to do is to further confusion and deluded thinking if you're teaching something that's not possible. Yet, Buddhism in general was presented to me that way for many, many years, that the mysteries are what's the word it's often used? That doesn't matter. The mysteries can't be solved, but go ahead and practice anyway, because at some point in endless lifetimes in the future, you might just be lucky enough to awaken. Rather than, this is what an awakened human being taught, if you do this, you'll awaken, because that's what the Buddha taught. But he taught that we need to be very clear and very diligent about what we're developing as Dhamma practice. And this leads to these three factors, the concentration factors of right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Simply to be mindful of what is right effort, the Buddha teaches here. What is right mindfulness? He teaches it here, but he also teaches it in the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta. The proper application of concentration and mindfulness is described in both of those suttas. The Buddha concludes this instruction by, be mindful of wrong effort and enter and remain in right effort, and that's the task associated with right effort. Simple and direct. And now we don't even have the excuse of, well, I don't know what right effort is. Right effort is utilizing the proper meditation method to deepen concentration, to hold in mind the factors of mindfulness as the Buddha taught that. I'm going to skip forward a little bit. I'm going to go forward to the Samadhi Sutta because you've read this and we've talked about it a lot, and we're going to go over this again in a couple of weeks. Anyway, so let me just go ahead to the Samadhi Sutta if I can find it. The Buddha addresses those in attendance. Friends, there are four qualities that are developed from concentration. Concentration, when developed in practice, leads to developing peace and calm here and now. Of course, the essence of a well-concentrated mind is a mind that is well-concentrated. It's not distracted by agitating thoughts and concepts. It doesn't hold in mind anything that would be agitating because it recognizes that, the disturbance, and simply lets it go. The Buddha talks about right mindfulness is founded in thinking what we want to think when we want to think it. And isn't that remarkable that we are given the tools and we all have the innate ability to develop that level of concentration, to think what we want to think when we want to think it. Two, developing useful knowledge and true vision. Useful knowledge and true vision, of course, as it relates to the Dhamma. The Buddha didn't teach physics, he didn't teach politics, he didn't teach history, he didn't teach anything else except a Dhamma, a path for human beings to awaken. And within that, there's useful knowledge, there's useful vision, and there's useless knowledge. There's knowledge that would serve to continue distraction. Three, developing refined mindfulness and attentiveness. And that means knowing what to hold in mind, what to put our thoughts, what to focus our thoughts on. Four, developing the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion. So how does the development of concentration lead to peace and calm here and now? When properly engaged in shamatha vipassana meditation, one is withdrawn from sensuality, unskillful mental qualities. They enter and remain in the first jhana. You know how we talked about that before. Jhanas are often portrayed as these exalted levels of meditation that only extremely advanced meditators can attain. Simply not true. These are the Buddha's words on jhana. The Buddha taught jhana, four levels of meditative absorption, simply so that we can recognize that our meditation practice is bearing fruit. We're deepening our concentration. How do we do this? As concentration deepens, they enter and remain in the first jhana, which is accompanied by focused thought and insight. It simply means that we've started our meditation practice and we've been able to hold in mind, even if it's just briefly, the sensation of breathing in our bodies. That's the first jhana. Every one of us has had that experience. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the second jhana, which is focused thoughts and insight. The delight and pleasure are there, but they're born of composure and inner poise. So I think we were talking just a little bit about this. It's okay to have pleasurable experiences in meditation. It's okay to feel peace and calm. The Buddha points out even the necessity to recognize when that develops. Simply don't attach yourself to that feeling, because meditation, even the experience of meditation, is going to be impermanent. There's going to be some sessions that feel like it's just the most natural thing in the world to be mindful of our breath, and then there'll be times when it struggles, just when we're struggling just to maintain mindfulness of the breath for one breath, and then we lose it. And that doesn't matter. When we remember that meditation is for deepening concentration, every time we come back to the sensation of breathing, Every time we recognize that we're caught up in our thoughts and come back to the sensation of breathing, we're deepening concentration. And I would say that every time we avoid doing anything else in meditation except come back to the sensation of breathing, we're avoiding distraction and we're deepening concentration. There's nowhere in any of the suttas that I've come across, and I've read a lot of them, where the Buddha gives any other instructions except what we give here and what we've covered in the Satipatthana and Anapanasati Sutta. He doesn't teach to use meditation for contemplation, meaning bring a phrase or a topic and think about it. That doesn't deepen concentration. He doesn't teach to bring sensations in and focus on those sensations or breathe into sensations. The only way that the Buddha taught to use our breath is as a point of focus, to deepen concentration, to support the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. If we want to do other breath-based or so-called mindfulness-based instructions, that's fine, or practices. Just be clear that they're outside of what the Buddha taught as an Eightfold Path. And the only reason is so that we don't start introducing practices that in a very subtle way distract us from our own Dhamma practice, which is really what happens all the time. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the third jhana, which is delight and pleasure, and delight and pleasure and the perception of pleasure and pain disappear. Equanimity and refined mindfulness increases, and a peaceful mind prevails. And again, I think we've all had that experience, even if it was just briefly. Now, again, the Buddha is not teaching advanced mind states, and we shouldn't take it as an advanced mind state simply from the fact that we're able to deepen our concentration. But it is important to recognize these ever-deepening levels of meditative absorption, the jhanas. The fourth level is a mind of equanimity. But maintaining that fourth level is what an awakened human being does without effort. It's what we, as we're developing awakening, are developing ourselves towards, a mind of lasting peace and equanimity. And again, how do we know we're awakened? There's no longer any agitation in our mind. If our minds aren't quite there yet, what do? Keep engaging in right effort and the other factors of the Eightfold Path. And it really is that simple. And then the other instruction that I would give, now that we're closing out this section on the Eightfold Path, is just to say again, avoid introducing other practices that seem like they're wholesome. They might even add to this. Keep your Dhamma practice pure and you will develop awakening as the Buddha described awakening. And here's the way I look at that. If the Buddha came across something in his 45-year teaching career, he certainly would have added it to his teachings, but I've never come across a fifth noble truth or a ninth factor of the Eightfold Path or anything like that. The Buddha awakened and he taught this consistent Dhamma practice for the next 45 years of his life. The only difficulty in it is that there's no way to exclude adding to it, exclude what a self-referential ego self wants to continually do, which is attach itself to new ideas, new thoughts, new ways to establish itself, which is beyond the scope of even an awakened human being. And think about the arrogance in that statement. I know better than an awakened human being. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do that type of chanting and this type of bowing and this type of visualization and this and on and on and on. When we get to the point that this practice no longer even resembles something the Buddha taught, which is a simple and direct path, an Eightfold Path. So that's today's talk. Next week we're going to get into the three marks of existence, and I'll give a talk on that separate from what you'll read, and we might even separate that out for a couple of weeks because there's a lot in there. But any questions about this talk, and then we'll go around the room. Everybody understands the Eightfold Path and its usefulness and that it's the framework for our Dhamma practice. Kevin, good to see you.
Yes, it's nice that these talks, the whole Eightfold Path has been reviewed again. Yeah. You know, we're concluding that. And I think you know, as we were talking about before, when with a really steady meditation practice, I think you can experience the jhanas.
Yeah.
And while Buddha warns it shouldn't be the goal, it's there. maybe it just touches upon what is there to awakening. You can start to see what awakening might look like.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that's precisely why the Buddha taught it, so that we know that we're developing the path appropriately. Which he taught, it's something that we should be mindful of. Is my practice bearing fruit? If not, do something else. Or maybe you need to refine it within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Okay. Thank you, Kevin. Greg, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. Yeah, I don't have much to say. The Eightfold Path has been working very well for me. And I really understand and appreciate what you say about not introducing other things that aren't included in the original teaching as part of understanding now what proper or right meditation is in the context of the Eightfold Path,
yeah.
And then seeing other forms of meditation that, if they're not hindrances, could be used almost as a hobby, like, you know.
Yeah.
Buddha wouldn't say, hey, you enjoy skateboarding, don't skateboard. Hey, you enjoy this, don't do that. If it's not harmful to your practice, but that's the funny thing with meditation, because the more you do any of these mental exercises, I feel like the more they're going to try and come in during your right
yep.
practice.
Yep.
So I've definitely had that feeling of when you return to the breath, you get that little thought like, oh, good job, you're doing it right. And now, as you said, I forget how exactly, but when you don't do the other practices during that time or when those things aren't allowed to interfere, that's another time when now I feel like, oh, good job, you're not only are you doing it proper, but you're not indulging these other often they feel good. Often, if you're bored in your meditation, you do something that it alleviates the boredom, when really you were probably thinking about something you shouldn't have been, just come back to the breath. So
yeah.
I appreciate all that. And the quote that you have in every email about if you adapt your teachings to...
So
what your students you feel like to keep their attention or something along those lines, and adapting the teaching, and it's gonna lose the truth of the original Dhamma. And
yeah.
So I love about this place.
Thank you, Greg. That was a decision that I had to make when I first started teaching. I'm gonna teach something that's authentic. And the reason why I was teaching back then was to generate money for charity, so you could make the argument that the focus should be to get as many butts on the chairs as possible. But again, the more I thought about that, again, it's getting back to what the Buddha would... To me, it's the essence of cruelty to teach something in the context of the Dhamma when I know that it's just misleading. Even another type of popular meditation might be easier for people. In fact, I know that initially just a meditation practice where you really don't do too much keeps people interested a lot longer, because they don't have to come up against their own views. This is something different. This is well focused. It's what the Buddha taught. And it's important to understand that on an individual level, because not many of us, I've met very few people that never meditated in any way. I think, Kevin, you might be one of the purists, that you were pretty close to just this.
Yeah.
And just a few others. And the ones that have not had a meditation practice prior to coming to what the Buddha taught have a much easier time, and by and large, in developing it, because their mind isn't conditioned towards something else. It's many, many years since I started with TM. And it would be many, many years into my meditation practice that I stopped doing TM, that the technique I'd find myself just doing it. Because it's so subtle, and almost any meditation technique is going to be a very subtle thing that we're conditioning our minds to do. So it's also something to be cautious about. You know, or do we really want to condition our minds? I've known many people that insisted on just meditating, which is how one school of Buddhism portrays it. Well, just meditate long and hard, and eventually, you know. I've known people that develop deep psychoses from doing just that. Because you think about, if you don't have the right framework, and all you're doing is an intensive internal focus without any framework to recognize what's churning around inside, it's very easy to lead yourself deeper and deeper into psychoses. And I'm not saying everybody that meditates without the right meditation is going to do that, but I've seen it occur. So you're right to recognize it, Greg, and to recognize also that it's working, that this practice that I'm putting so much effort in is bearing fruit. And once you see it bearing fruit, why wouldn't you then want to keep it more focused? Because you realize it's taking you a place where something that you might have been doing in general for many, many years wasn't quite doing, like was my experience. And even if it's not that, even if you really enjoy another so-called meditation practice, if you want to develop the Eightfold Path, you'll put two sessions in of Shamatha Vipassana and then maybe do something else if you want. But what I found is it delivers awakening, which is really what I was chasing for many years. So thank you for bringing that up. Diane, good to see you.
You say things and you give a talk and you make it sound like, okay, you know, get it with a snap of the fingers. And
yeah, why not?
I have to work at it really, really hard. When I read the section this time on concentration, some paragraphs, I mean, I've read them before, but I've had to go over them and say almost word for word to let the definition of the words sink in, each word to, you know, connect the dots for me. And I don't feel really intelligent sometimes or very smart because I have to concentrate so hard on it. But it's the thing is, though, the effort of it, the work of it, is so rewarding. But I think what I experience almost is it's a chiseling away, chipping away at the conditioned thinking that I have and replacing it. And I have, you know, a lot of years of conditioned thinking to whittle away. And it's just worth the work at paying attention to what the words mean, da 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 da. It's really cool and helpful to be gentle with myself. I'm so glad you say that, because I think as an American I have a tendency to beat up myself, and that helps when I'm struggling with some things. I mean, it's not that the words or anything is that complicated. It's just reconnecting the synapses so that, because they're so stuck in certain, you know, in the conditioned thinking, that it takes, I'm sluggish sometimes at connecting all the dots.
Yeah, thank you. Some of the terms are unfamiliar, but I think the biggest difficulty is that a conditioned mind is conditioned to ignore its own ignorance, and so these words that are challenging our own ignorance, we have a natural resistance to them. And it does take time, it does take repetition, you know, for most people. But as we talk about almost every week here in class, you hear something new. You've heard it for 20 times, but tonight you heard it in a way that made sense and was useful, and you start integrating the Eightfold Path. And it's just that way. Does anybody, I think I asked this Tuesday, does anybody here tonight think that the Eightfold Path cannot be fully developed? So you all believe that you can develop the Eightfold Path and awaken? You should, because that's how it's taught. You know, again, using the Buddha's words, if it wasn't possible, he wouldn't have taught it. He wouldn't have spent 45 years of his life teaching what he felt was the most important thing to teach if he didn't think it was going to be possible for people to awaken. And they did. I mean, he got instant feedback on his very first teaching, Khandana Awakened. And then over the course of the next couple of weeks, many of the now 1,000 folks in his Sangha awakened by the time they got to that third sutta that we listen to on, or that we talk about on Saturday night on retreats. You know, it's one of the reasons why I structure the retreats that way, is so that we can hear in that context the Buddha's first three teachings, and then this year's retreat we're going to get into some other things on the Satipatthana Nyanaponasati Sutta. But again, to teach something in a way that we can actually have the experience of developing it. Because just like Greg was saying, if we don't have the experience of it, we're not likely to continue, are we? But as we start seeing our minds become more well concentrated and we learn the most important things to hold in mind, a natural, joyful enthusiasm takes over because it's working, because our lives are getting better. Our minds are more calm. Our interactions with others are much more pleasant. Our interactions with ourselves are much more pleasant. Really is worth the price of admission. So, any other questions or comments? So we've reviewed the three divisions that are applied naturally to the Eightfold Path. We've looked at the wisdom factors, the virtuous factors, and now the concentration factors. So now we're going to start studying what we're gaining insight into. Why do we deepen our concentration and develop the framework of the Eightfold Path so that we can gain a very specific insight into the impermanence of all things, the misunderstanding of what we think is a self, anatta, and the resulting dukkha that comes from a misunderstanding of impermanence and anatta, the not-self characteristic. Is that part of this clear? That it's because of that misunderstanding that we end up creating suffering in our lives? Again, so that really is the specific insight that we're gaining. Again, nothing mystical, nothing magical. We want to understand the inner relationship between a misunderstanding of self and the impermanence of all things in the world, and the resulting dukkha that follows from that misunderstanding. So that's what you'll read this week, and I'll give a talk on another article. Just we'll have a lot of fodder for next week's talk. Few announcements. Matt is teaching Qigong here this Saturday. This is the third Saturday, so immediately after our class, beginning at 10:30, Matt has a Qigong class. And if you haven't, you know, it's such a great addition to our Dhamma practice. Our retreat is coming up May 7th to the 20th. Please reserve your space as soon as you can.
May
17th. May 7th. What did I say?
7th, yeah.
May 17th to May 20th.
two weeks.
Yeah, there's only... I think there's only one quad bed left for the women and two for the men. And I think there's two and two on single beds, too. There's plenty of doubles, but please sign up early, as early as you can. We have our painting Sangha Day is March the 4th at Raritan Learning Cooperative. There's some info on the website, but it's from one to whenever. Please put some time aside, and we're going to have a Sangha painting party down there. I think that's it. So find your relaxed meditation posture.
Do you have people signing up for the painting?
Well, I think I will. We should know. I'll send an announcement out in Monday's email asking for people to just get back to me.
I'll be away then, unfortunately.
Ah. Well, you can just go to the next Sunday by yourself.
Okay.
So we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great